Barely Research Facts is a fact-based podcast brought to you by Art Now Das, an experiential arts agency based out of Mumbai. Each week, we pick a word at random, dive into it, and see what it brings to us. We are your hosts. My name is Ragini, and this is Shar. Let's go.
Hi, guys, and welcome back to another episode of Barely Research Facts. The interesting word for today is signal. So, Ragini.
Yes.
Prehistoric man.
Yes. I feel like this is leading to something really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Prehistoric man, how do you think they communicated?
Signals.
Yes. So one of the methods that they used was smoke signals.
So I was half right.
Yeah, you were mostly right, actually. They did use some sort of signaling. It's a very cheating sort of answer, but it's okay. I'll accept it. But yeah, so they used fire and smoke signals. They also used drum messages to encode information. And obviously, it had to be very simple messages like, is safe, is danger, is hungry. I don't know. Mine would be hungry, like top of the list.
Constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, so they used smoke signals, drum messages to create a sort of alarm system for different clans that lived further apart than just like shouting distance like, hey, Jeff, I'm hungry. You'd think that when we talk about smoke signals that the first image that comes to mind is obviously is Native Americans. And in all the old Westerns, the settling populations also sort of adopted smoke signals. And, you know, it was pretty standard. Just light a fire. I'm assuming it's pretty standard. Light a fire with some wet sticks and then just use your least favorite blanket to create, like, you know, smoke signals. So the reason that I went through this long-winded explanation was I wanted to talk about a really interesting method of using beacons that the Byzantine Empire used.
Ooh.
Byzantine, whatever you want to call them. They used a system of beacons to transmit messages across Asia Minor to Constantinople. So this is, we're talking like hundreds of kilometers, like over 700 kilometers. Yeah, so a message could be transmitted the entire length of this line within an hour.
Wow.
So yeah, so hundreds of kilometers, things that would usually you'd have a, you know, sore bottom riding a horse and carriage or just a horse across could be done within an hour. And this is, we're talking the mid-9th century. There's this guy called Leo the Mathematician, simple name. So a clever guy, he developed a system of mountaintop beacons that allowed for visual communication from the Arab frontier to the Great Palace in Constantinople. So if there was, you know, an army approaching or there was any kind of danger or if Jeff was hungry, you know, all these things could be communicated just in an hour.
Jeff really travels across the time, place.
Time, space, everything. He's going to become a mascot shortly. Yeah. So Leo set up two identical water clocks in Constantinople and at the Lulon fortress on the Arab frontier. And different messages were assigned to each of the 12 hours. And the lighting of a bonfire at the beacon in the Taurus Mountains sent the corresponding message to Constantinople. And, you know, it really actually preserved their military position and their empire really for longer than it would have if they didn't have it. So that's the story of the Byzantine Empire's system of beacons. And does it remind you of anything, Ragini? Something to do with a ring and a lord of it.
Oh, yeah. The beacons of the beacon Gondor. Of Gondor, yes.
Yeah. So just as a little aside, I'm sure a lot of people listening probably have made the connection already. But yeah, there was Kingdom of Gondor. They used a similar system to raise the alarm in the north and south of Gondor, respectively. There are some differences between the book version and the movie version, but it's been agreed that there were 7 beacons and they were on really elevated mountain tops. And during the War of the Ring is when we see that the beacons were lit when at Minas Tirith, which is the capital of Gondor, when it was under siege. And then the Rohirrim, which is the people of Rohan, rode to Gondor's aid. And the music is epic and the visuals are epic. And just go watch the movie, okay?
Oh, yeah. So moving from signals from empires in the past to moving to signals that possibly come from outer space.
Aliens.
Very good. I came across this interesting little anecdote about a signal that was received on 15th August 1977 by the Ohio State University's radio telescope. The signal is called the WOW signal. And why it is called the WOW signal is also really interesting. But it was a strong narrowband radio signal. Telescope at the Ohio State University was called Big Ear, and it was at the time being used to sort of further their studies in support of finding extraterrestrial intelligence.
Mm.
The signal appears to have come from the direction of the constellation Sagittarius, and bore the expected hallmarks of extraterrestrial origin. The astronomer at the time who discovered the anomaly a few days later, his name was Jerry R. Emin, and he discovered the anomaly while reviewing the recorded data. He was so impressed with the result that he circled the reading on the computer printout and wrote the comment, "Wow," by its side, which led to, you know, its widely used name as the Wow signal.
Mm, see, Ragini, it's not just me that's simple.
That's what, yeah, because if you actually went to things, the 6EQUJ5 signal, which is actually what the signal was, or the printout was, I don't think it'd be as popular.
No, yeah. Probably not.
I mean, aliens are not. It's the simplicity of it that really
they should have just called it aliens.
It aliens.
Aliens, exclamation point.
Okay, so the entire signal sequence lasted for a full 72-second window, during which the Big Ear, which is what the radio telescope at The Ohio State University was nicknamed as, was able to observe it, and it has not been detected since, despite several subsequent attempts by astronomers, including Emin and his team and others. Multiple hypotheses have been advanced for the origin of the emission, including natural human-made sources, etc., etc., but none of them so far have adequately explained the signal. And therefore, to date, it remains possibly the strongest candidate for alien radio transmission ever detected. There have, of course, been a number of hypotheses that have been advanced about why, you know, what could have possibly been like an explainable source of the signal. These have included something called an interstellar scintillation of a weaker continuous signal, which is basically similar in effect to some sort of atmospheric twinkling. But at the same time, none of, you know, other hypotheses have included a rotating lighthouse-like source within, you know, that hasn't been detected yet, a signal sweeping in frequency, or just a random one-time burst.
Mm.
But none of these have really been proven to a point of widespread acceptance. At the same time, Emin, who was the astronomer who discovered the signal, did have a bit of skepticism about whether it was aliens or not. He did say that we should have been able to see it again when we looked for it 50 times over and over. Something suggests that it was an Earth source signal that simply got reflected off a piece of space debris. But he later then recanted his skepticism after further research showed that an Earthbound signal was very unlikely, because the signal was transmitted at a frequency of 1,420 megahertz, which incidentally is the same frequency as hydrogen. And usually in the search for extraterrestrial entities, it is considered that because hydrogen is the most commonly found element in the universe, any marginally intelligent entity would be familiar with hydrogen, and therefore it would be technology that would be familiar to civilizations, any potential civilizations that could exist in outer space. And therefore, in that context, 420 megahertz signal originating from Earth is usually within a protected spectrum, a bandwidth reserved for astronomical purposes only, in which terrestrial transmitters are forbidden to transmit. So therefore, it's unlikely that something from Earth would have sent out a signal at the same frequency. And so he eventually recanted his skepticism, though I don't think he's completely convinced of this it alien hypothesis that has come about. But I think he's not saying yes or no to it, much like me. So maybe I'm on my way to being
Amen.
To being an expert without knowing it. So in 2017, there was a team, an astronomical team, that suggested that the signal might have come from a hydrogen cloud accompanying a comet. And this was possibly the closest that we ever got to explaining the signal. And additionally, the movement of the comet would explain why the signal was not ever seen again. The team noted that the two comets had been in the same part of the sky the time that Big Ear was monitoring on that particular day in 1977. And the two comets, which were P/2008 Y2 Gibbs and 266/P Christensen, had not yet been discovered. So it's likely that this could have been just, you know, them picking up something that they didn't even know about back in the day, but has since gone on being explained. The team then got a better chance to test their ideas as the two comets appeared once again in a night sky in somewhere in November 2016 through, I think, somewhere into early 2017. And the radio signals matched those from the WOW signal 40 years ago. To verify the results, they tested the readings of the three other comets as well and found similar results. And the researchers acknowledge that they cannot say with certainty that the WOW signal was generated by the same comets, but they can say with relative assurance that it was generated by a comet.
Oh, boo!
Yeah, kind of a buzzkill, right?
Oh.
So you will be happy to know, clearly controversy queen, that this hypothesis was dismissed by astronomers.
Yes!
Including members of the original Big Ear research team, as the sighted comets were not in beam at the correct time. Furthermore, the comets do not emit strongly at the frequencies involved, and there is no explanation why a comet would be observed in one beam but not in the other. So, still up in the air.
Aliens.
Yes. In conclusion.
In conclusion, it aliens. Yeah, I like that. I like that hypothesis best.
Yeah, so that is the story of famous signals from outer space that could or could not be aliens, but according to us now, and since we've solved it, it is aliens.
Okay, from outer space, I want to bring you back, Ragini, onto terra firma. Okay. Sometime around the First World War. So when I was looking up signals, I was really interested in how different militaries or different at different points in history, how people communicated during war. And World War II was, you know, it was pretty standard. Electricity was well established. So, you know, the telegraph and Morse code, telephones, all of this was being used to the hilt. But the First World War, I thought, was an interesting point in history because electricity had been researched at this point and it had been sort of incorporated into sort of daily life, like the light bulb and things like that. But also at the same time, it was on the cusp of turning over, switching over. So interestingly, during the First World War, they were using electricity for the first time during a war, and they were using it for communication and to signal to each other in different ways. But also alongside it, they were also using pretty rudimentary ways of communicating, like, you know, pigeons and animals like a dog. I will come to that a little later. But I'm just going to pause here and introduce this term called a semaphore. A semaphore is a method of visual signaling, usually by means of flags or lights and such like. Before the invention of the telegraph, semaphore signaling from high towers was used to transmit messages between distant points. And it's interesting because different people came up with different methods of doing it. I'm not going to go into too much detail about the different ways, just mentioning them briefly. There were flag semaphores, which is, you know, people used it to communicate with each other on land. And also it was used by the Navy. So on the mast of the ship, they'd have different flags, combinations of flags that would signal a certain message, even spelling out messages to people who, you know, were part of the code.
Oh,
yeah, it was. I mean, obviously, they had to come up with different ways of doing this, right? Now, I wanted to talk about wig-wag,
okay,
purely because of the name. So this is going further back in history to the American Civil War. It was developed by a U.S. Army major called Albert Meyer, and it was based on the idea of the Morse code, each letter being represented by a series of dots and dashes. So they use one flag waving back and forth in a series of wags to represent each letter of the message. Yeah. And there were two basic wig-wag flags, one white with a red center and one red with a white center. The white flag was used at dusk or dawn where, you know, visibility was low, and the red was used during days with bright sunshine. So each letter had three basic movements: down to the left, down to the right, or down in the front of the signalman. Can you imagine the the utter panic of the signalman? I would be panicked. I would be a fully panicking signalman if I was like, oh God, I've forgotten what C was. I'm just going to use K instead.
Oh, God.
So since it was based upon Morse code, it could take up to five waves of the flag for a single letter. To the untrained eye, it looked as though the signalman was just wagging the flag around, like in no particular way, which is what I would be doing. But they utilized the wig-wag through till the end of World War One, and they changed to more widely used systems of semaphore during World War II.
Wow.
So the semaphore is sort of, yeah, and it goes further back, as you'll find out in my next segment, but it goes, you know, all the way back to the Greeks. So
ooh,
it's really interesting as a non-electrical way of signaling to someone.
Yeah.
Very innovative.
Yeah, also like if it was somebody like you signaling, I think that'd be quite a quick end to the war because both sides would be like, what is going on here?
What the hell is this person saying?
And everyone's got their own interpretations. Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah. So you remember how I was mentioning that they were still using pretty rudimentary ways of communicating with each other during World War One? They were using animal messengers. They utilized homing pigeons. And I wanted to talk about this one particular homing pigeon called Cherami,
okay,
who was a hero. This pigeon, apparently it saved the Lost Battalion 9 during World War One. In October of 1918, 500 men of the U.S. Army 77th Infantry Division were trapped behind the enemy lines in the Argonne Forest. They were surrounded by German forces, and unfortunately, the Allies weren't aware that they were there, so they only had it down as an enemy position, so they were busy bombarding the position. So what did Major Charles Whittlesey do? He sent his last bird. They usually carried around two birds.
Oh, okay.
He sent his last bird. Yeah, Share Ami with the message, "We are along the road parallel 276.4. Our artillery is dropping a barrage directly on us. For heaven's sake, stop it." pretty direct. Despite being wounded, Share Ami managed to get the message across 25 miles in 25 minutes.
Aww.
And he saved 194 of the 500 who went in.
Wow.
Yeah, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for his actions.
So cute.
And I don't know if it's, I mean, this is probably in respect, but he was stuffed and is on display at the Smithsonian American History Museum in Washington, D.C. So you can go have a look at Share Ami.
Oh, okay. I wonder what he did to live out the rest of his days. Like, was he in like a little cage in some army facility?
I don't know. I feel like I'm getting an image of him just laying on a velvet cushion being fed grapes by many female pigeons. And if you want to hear about our second hero, who was Sergeant Stubby, who was a Staffordshire Terrier who became the mascot of the 102nd Infantry, 26th Yankee Division. He was in France. He was essentially there to be a mascot. But when he arrived, he showed that he had great talent for much more. His heightened sense of smell allowed him to warn the men of impending poison gas attacks. And he could locate wounded soldiers.
Wow.
So he'd either lead them to safety or back to alert the medics. And once he even caught a German spy attempting to copy a map of the Allies' position. How did he know?
Yeah.
So Stubby was pretty badass. He was even given the rank of sergeant for his actions against the German spy. He was wounded at the Battle of Seicheprey in April 1918 and was sent to a Red Cross hospital for recovery. And he, even there, while recovering, boosted the morale by
just being cheerful and wagging his tail around the place.
Yeah, boosted morale by just doing that. And he's so cute. And there's a picture of him and we'll put it up and you must look at it and just, just love him. And similarly to Share Ami, Sergeant Stubby is on display at the Smithsonian American History Museum in Washington, D.C.
Wow. Okay, so moving on to another story from the Signal Corps. And just to clarify, the Signal Corps is the branch of any military that deals with communications. And the story this time is not based in America, though. I'm moving it over to Colombia. And this is around the time that the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which when translated into Spanish, abbreviates to FARC, which was a highly insurgent left-wing militant group that was operating in Colombia and has led to probably one of the longest civil wars in a country in contemporary world history. So the FARC was still active in Colombia in 2010. And one of the main sources of revenue or funding for the FARC was they would take hostages. So a lot of their kidnappings were, of course, you know, they would kidnap a lot of soldiers sent in for military operations. But they would also kidnap American citizens, usually for the money. And they'd kidnap higher ranking Colombian citizens for some kind of political leverage. And prisoners who were in these hostages, they could be like just held for periods as long as like 18 years. Sometimes some prisoners have been held. And the conditions were fairly terrible and revolting. So a lot of people have come out of it and have, like, their stories are quite horrific in terms of just the conditions that they were kept in. And so, you know, Colonel Jose Espejo, who was a communications expert in the Colombian army, was now actually at the time of this on the brink of retirement, but was also really finding it difficult to move on with knowing that his countrymen were in these situations, in these hostage camps. So what he needed to do was he needed to urgently get a message to captured Colombian soldiers telling them that help was coming. Now, at the time, there were multiple commando missions that were taking place throughout the region. And there was an operation that involved 300 government soldiers, secret raids, and they were sort of going and attacking FARC camps deep within the jungle because that's where the FARC would operate from. And the FARC had a reputation of shooting hostages as soon as there was any whiff of any kind of military invasion. So it was extremely important that the hostages get the message so that they would flee as soon as possible. They recognized that there was help around and that they ran into the forest and the jungles, they would be rescued. But at the same time, he had to get the message across to them without letting the FARC rebels kind of know what was going on. So and so that was a big challenge. And so how does he go about doing this? He goes about doing this by collaborating with a gentleman called Juan Carlos Ortiz, who was an advertising executive in America. Now, Ortiz was Colombian, but at some point in time, worked on a government ad campaign, which was anti-cocaine. And the ad was so popular and it was amazingly well-received. It won him a Gold Lion at Cannes. You know, he was this big rising star in the advertising field in Colombia. And then this ad went out and the FARC suddenly had a beef with him because a big part of the funding for the FARC also comes from cocaine, from the cocaine market. So thereafter, he was threatened. He was, you know, his family was threatened, and eventually it got so bad that he had to be transferred to New York. From there, continued to work as an advertising executive in America. But needless to say, his own personal beef with the FARC continued. And so multiple times in the past, he had been brought on board with the Colombian army to kind of work out some really unique and interesting advertising campaigns targeted at the FARC. And when he got this message, he was extremely excited to come back on board and see what he could do. So he moved back to Bogota and they started brainstorming. And so the thinking about what to do, and, you know, at some point in time, suddenly they realized that one of the things that they could potentially do is communicate with the hostages via radio, because the FARC would provide most hostages with radio that they could just listen to. More than sort of from a humanitarian perspective, this was just to kind of keep their minds occupied as they kind of trekked across the forest, and they just kind of kept them from like thinking about escape. So they thought it was a good way of kind of numbing the senses. But a lot of hostages had access to a radio. And at this time, also, there was a gentleman called Herbin Hoyos Medina, who came up with an idea in 1994 after he was kidnapped for 17 days to create a radio show in which he would give 30-second spots to families of hostages so they could send out heartwarming messages to the hostages. And they were allowed to hear this.
What?
So they started thinking about this. So they're like, okay, cool. So we know that they have radio. Then we know that they have access to a radio. So what can we do? And so now they start thinking about the next step, which is potentially the BRAC in their heads. And they kind of, they come up with the idea of using Morse code. Now, Morse code is a great way to do this because a lot of the Colombian army soldiers in their training have studied Morse code. The FARC usually has, you know, they're untrained. They usually, they don't really come from military background. So it's unlikely that they would be able to understand Morse code. So seems like it's a bit of a far shot, but it could potentially work. But again, how do you get a Morse code message onto a radio station and not have the FARC smell anything fishy about it?
Yeah.
So they decided that they will create a hit song. And so now suddenly there is this whole, and everyone's on board and they're like, yeah, it's great. And now suddenly there is, you know, there is this little buzz going around the air that the Colombian army is looking to create a hit song and they're trying to get it on the Lista 40 Colombia Billboard charts. And most people are quite convinced that this is a joke because it can't be real. But at the same time, they approach a producer, Carlos Portela, who also thought they were nuts initially, but then kind of realized how they were deadly serious. They began to work. And it's actually amazing because if you think the military was so specific about what they wanted and they just needed to know that a message could be hidden in a song. So they begin to experiment with Morse code using various percussion instruments and a keyboard. And what they learned is that most operators who are skilled in Morse code can often read the signals at a rate of 40 words per minute. But if you play it that fast, it sounds a bit like EDM-y. It wasn't the most popular vibe at that time. And so they discovered that the magic number to be played around with was 20. So you can fit approximately 20 Morse code words into a piece of music, the length of a chorus, and it would probably sound okay. So now, with the help of military policemen skilled in Morse, they coded the message. The message was, 19 people rescued, you are next, don't lose hope. It was a signal to boost morale, indicate that help was nearby. Mm-hmm. And then the song was written, which was written by Portela himself. And the lyrics were, it was like this thinly veiled ballad about being a hostage. And, you know, it's about like just a message of hope to them. The lyrics, I'm translating it into English, of course, but like lyrics are in the middle of the night, thinking about what I love the most. I feel the need to sing about how much I miss them. And it kind of goes like this. And then in an extremely brave move, he even added the lyric, listen to this message, brother, just before the coded message kicks in. And the code, we will play this because it's just, it's amazing just to see how they've come up with it. But the code sounds, I've heard the song and the sound, it's beautiful because it does sound a bit like, it sounds like a song of hope and freedom. And it's a bit, of course, the, you know, the tune and stuff is a bit cliche, but it really works for this. And then the chorus comes in and the code actually sounds like a little bit of a synth interlude just after the chorus. And then they, you know, they played with it multiple times because not only was it important to blend it in, and there were lots of times, Morse code isn't musical. It's not meant to be musical. So there were lots of times where it would sound a bit jarring. It sounded a bit odd. So they had to keep reworking and keep playing with the music so that it would sound like a piece of the song. And also they had to be able to fit it in at least three times in the song because they needed to be sure that the message was going through. Finally, in September 2010, the song was mastered. They titled it Better Days. And now was the big problem of being able to release it without once again creating big, you know, stir about why is the military like insisting on having the song play on all of our radios. So they couldn't go to any of the commercial radio stations, but what they realized is that deep within the jungles where the hostage camps were, they would normally only have access to Colombian state radio stations, which were controlled by the government. Mm. So this song just played all the time on the radio. And that was the plan. And so most people in cities didn't hear the song at all. But in the jungles and the rural areas, it got incredibly popular. They also took another really, really daring step. And they got a former hostage by the name of Major General Luis Mendieta Oval Erlendo to help the operation by appearing on live television and making an appeal directly to the guerrillas, asking them to please provide radios and allow their hostages radio access. Now, this could have gone either way. Luckily, the way it was perceived was that the guerrillas thought that it was, you know, just allow them to listen to the sound of their families, just allow them to have radio to have access to, you know, normalcy and normal world outside. The song was then played on over 130 small stations and heard by 3 million people. By December 2010, Better Days was echoing across the jungle and the plan worked.
Wow.
Later in December 2010, the FARC announced its plan to release 5 more hostages as a humanitarian gesture. And at this time, one former hostage was able to confirm the song's effectiveness, according to Colonel Espejo. He says that the soldier spoke of hearing the song, the code hidden in the song, and revealed how the message was passed from soldier to soldier. So the song was even enjoyed by the FARC, who were oblivious to its message. So basically, it did work. A lot of people were rescued, and this just continued. Now, just to wrap things up at this end, eventually, Colonel Espejo finally did retire from the military. He now works as a journalist. In 2011, the army agreed to declassify the code. That's what this operation was called, the code, and allowed the song to be entered into the Cannes festival once again. Better Days earned Ortiz his second Gold Lion. And wow. The first time when he won the Gold Lion, he was eventually driven out of his country. But the second time around, it also gave him a place in the American Advertising Federation's Hall of Fame and on a top 10 list of exceptional Colombians. But I really like how Ortiz ends it all. He says, "The first time I earned it, one moment I was the king of the world, and the next I was just another Colombian victim of the terrorists. Being able to help the military with the code project was my way of helping them fight. The second time, I could finally enjoy it." And I will play the song because it's just beautiful and you have to hear it. And tell me if you can catch the Morse code in it.
Oh my God, that's so cool. I'm sure you guys caught the Morse code-y
yeah.
bit.
And the song does just sound really hopeful and lovely, right?
It does. It sounds like, yeah, it does sound hopeful. You're right. It almost brought a tear to my eye.
Yeah, it does, actually. Aww. And also as an additional side note, there was a time, one of the reasons why Ortiz was so keen on this project was because as a young man, he had tried to make a career as a musician and hadn't gone very far with it. And so the idea of having a hit song to his name was quite exciting to him.
Bless him.
And so it already worked out. And that's, I thought it was one of the most amazing stories that I've come across in a while. That's a story of how the Colombian army and the Signal Corps in the Colombian army used a pop song to get to some really, really unusual ends.
Yeah, I love that story. I really do. I think it's hope is such an important thing, isn't it? Like when they heard that, I can imagine all of them, you know, even if just one guy, Jeff, got it, nobody else did.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like they would all, like one person got it and then people, like, you know, it started getting passed on within the soldiers and it did actually yield results and it did actually get people to like take a leap of faith and kind of like just realize that help was near and freedom was near. And yeah.
Oh, that's a lovely story. I love that. Loved it.
Yeah, I did too.
So, it's tough to follow, but I'm going to try anyway. Let's talk about the Greeks.
Okay.
So, remember earlier I was talking about semaphores, which is just any way to signal, a visual way to signal people. The Greeks used something called a hydraulic telegraph, which in typical Grecian fashion was innovative, was interesting, also was followed up by a more modern version that was created by the British, which I'll talk about a little later. So the hydraulic telegraph, the earliest one was developed in 4th century BC Greece. It was used by an unfortunately named Aeneas. Aeneas? Aeneas? To send a message. So in the 4th century BC, the hydraulic semaphore was designed as a method of communication across quite a long distance. And it also became quite vital during the First Punic War. So like smoke signals or beacons, it involved a network of identical containers on separate hills. Mm-hmm. So these containers were sort of, just imagine an upright cylinder, and they were exactly the same in height, volume, the amount of volume of liquid it could, you know, it had, diameter, everything. They had to be identical or it wouldn't work, basically. Mm-hmm. So each of these identical containers had a vertical rod floated inside it. And each of these rods had predetermined codes inscribed at various intervals along its length or height. So someone who wished to communicate would signal another with a torch. They would synchronize, okay, and then simultaneously open a spigot or a tap and drain the water in the cylindrical structure. And as the water drained, the lip of the cylinder would slowly, you know, point at different points on the vertical rod. And then they would signal again with the torch, and then they'd close the spigot so that the water would stop draining. And if all went well, the vertical rods would have stopped at the same point, and they would be basically pointing at one of the warnings that were inscribed on the rod. So if it said, I'm hungry on one vertical rod, it would say, I'm hungry on the other as well. And they'd be like, oh, right. Okay. So Jeff's hungry, you know,
but wow. Like, how far was this? Was these messages being transmitted? Like, were they walkable distances?
It was used across the vast empire of Alexander the Great. Everybody knows how much ground the man covered. So it was used across his empire. So it was quite a large area that it covered. And I imagine, I mean, historians say it worked, so it probably worked. But all I can think is, in the form of Chinese whispers, like... It, you know, between each site, there'd be a slight difference, and then the message would go from I'm hungry to let's attack everyone very quickly. So that's how I think it went. But apparently it worked and they used it.
Yeah.
So
it sounds like a very, but I guess long distance signaling was hard in the olden times.
I can imagine someone saying like, I can't tell what Jeff is saying. I'm just going to ride over there with a horse. Okay. You try and do this stupid spigot thing and I will go and ride there in a horse. I can imagine that having happened, especially if I was operating the spigot. Not having learned from the Greek example, or having learned from the Greek example, who knows which one it is, the British came up with another system that was also a hydraulic telegraph. They use water-filled pipes to effect changes to the water level in the receiver unit, thus limiting its range to the hydraulic pressure that could be generated at the transmitter's device. Now, if you want a further explanation of this, don't look at me. Just know that they didn't end up using this device, mostly because if it was in any kind of sub-zero condition temperature, then obviously it wouldn't work. You know, you'd need additional like heating and all this stuff that the British were just like, please stop. So this was in the 19th century, and shortly after was when electricity started being used, and then the telegraph and Morse code and telephones and electric bulbs and all this other stuff started coming into play. So the hydraulic telegraph really just sort of
fizzled out,
drained slowly out of humanity's imagination
until we brought it back. Okay,
so that's the story of the hydraulic telegraph.
So to end the podcast, I'm actually going to stick with the time period of the Greeks, and I'm going to talk about something that has been pervasive in mankind and social interactions since the time of the Greeks, which is the middle finger and how it's come to signal what it signals today. And so now this was actually really fascinating to me, because a lot of hand gestures have kind of evolved over a period of time, but the middle finger seems to have always signaled pretty much the same thing, which is a big fat FU basically. So in the ancient Greeks, showing the middle finger was a sign of, you know, it was extremely offensive, because it basically meant that you like to take it up the ass. And while at the time a lot of, you know, homosexual relationships were mostly accepted, and they weren't as taboo as they are even, you know, as they grew to be later on. And then in ancient Rome, once again, it kind of, you know, it had really violent connotations, because if I showed you the finger, it basically meant that, you know, I'm going to F you up. So it's kind of continued to mean the same thing, which is actually quite fascinating. There's also a really interesting like early example of that I came across from Aristophanes' 223rd BC play called The Clouds. In it, a character known as Strepsiades, tired of Socrates pontificating, decides to flip off the famed philosopher. And this is the dialogue, and I shall read it out now to you. Socrates, well, to begin with, they'll make you elegant in company, and you'll recognize the different rhythms, the enoplean, the dactylic, which is like a digit. Like a digit, says Strepsiades. By God, that is something I do know. Socrates, then tell me. Strepsiades, when I was a lad, a digit meant this. Strepsiades then sticks his middle finger straight up under Socrates' nose. So clearly it's been around a long time. There's also an incident that supposedly occurred in the 4th century BC concerning the famed orator Demosthenes and the philosopher Diogenes. Diogenes once was... I'm going to take a guess and say he wasn't very fond of Demosthenes because when... So Demosthenes was having lunch at an inn and then he walked away and Diogenes met some strangers who expressed a wish to see Demosthenes. Diogenes then stretched out his middle finger and said, "There goes the demagogue of Athens." So, polite.
I can't believe we're like laughing at like ancient jokes.
Like just ancient, like flipping it off.
Casually laughing at ancient jokes.
Now, in the 1st century AD, Caligula is supposed to have said to enjoy making powerful people kiss his ring while extending his middle finger at them and moving it kind of obscenely around them. So, it's unsurprising.
Simple pleasures of Caesar. Now,
the reason why I think that the gesture has continued to mean the same thing over the years is because the middle finger is the longest finger, and so the fingers around it kind of curled up, and it could be, you know, the penis and the testicles, and so it's kind of, I think the shape would endure. In some cultures, sometimes the thumb is replaced by the middle finger, and you know, it's equally not flattering, I guess.
Offensive.
Because I guess some cultures prefer girth to length.
This has taken such a turn, this whole episode.
Yeah, we've really moved from like... But then, of course, like, you know, slowly around the Middle Ages, they used the middle fingers, stopped sort of being used as freely. And I think it started becoming more and more insulting as Christianity began to be on the rise. And then suddenly in the 19th century, it came back in full force because there was a really famous photograph that popped up in the later half of the 1800s with a famous sports person with his hand on his teammate's shoulder and showing him with the middle finger stretched out for all to see. And so from then on, our generation has been blessed to have the middle finger back in full force and in all of its glory. And so that is the story of the signal of the middle finger.
Also, listen to our Game of Thrones podcast. No, I'm joking. Did you come across the English and French, the English archers and the French soldiers, that story with the middle finger?
No.
So the story goes that the English soldiers waved their fingers at French soldiers who had threatened to cut off their archers' first two fingers because that would render them pretty useless as archers. So this is during the Hundred Years' War, and that's one of the also reasons. So it's I like how it's changed throughout history, but the meaning's been pretty much the same. Pretty much the same offensive meaning.
Yeah, it's just I guess the cathartic nature of just, you know, with all of your emotions, flipping somebody off is hard to match, and that's what's permeated over the years.
Yeah. And I'd like to just end with just a tiny anecdote from my life where when I didn't know as much about being offensive, now I know a lot. I used to regularly put my ring finger up instead of my middle finger, thinking that it was offensive.
Because you were trying to be polite by not showing your middle finger, or because you just genuinely didn't know it was a middle finger?
No, I was just stupid. And if you actually try it, it's really difficult. And I managed it.
Yeah, so it's no way.
I'm going to pat myself on the back.
Yeah. Okay. You do that. So, yeah. And we will see you next time with a short episode now very soon. And then another long episode and another short episode. And it's just always around, guys.
Until eternity.
Yeah. Bye. See you.
See you guys.
Okay, that's it for today. The episode you just heard was edited by Mohit Chandilya. Music for the episode is by Charitha Arora. If you'd like to reach out to us about the podcast, the episode, or you just want to say hi in general, we're on Instagram as Barely Research Facts. You could also come to the website at www.artnowdoes.in. If you like the podcast, review, subscribe, and please share it with other podcast lovers in your circle. It would mean so much to us. Until next time, bye.